If you're a regular listener to Two Way Street, you know that every now and then we like to record our show in front of live audiences. And that's what we did with our guest today, Atlanta chef Asha Gomez. She operates Spice to Table, a critically praised cafe in the old Fourth Ward of Atlanta, which she opened after closing her high-end restaurant, Cardamom Hill. This show is especially fun for the Two Way Street team to produce because many of our listeners who asked to be in the audience are passionate followers of Asha's food. And so, as you'll hear, Asha had a big cheering section on hand, eager to listen to the conversation. Welcome to Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. We're going to be talking today with one of the most acclaimed chefs in the Southeast, Asha Gomez. And we're recording this show, Asha, in front of a live audience here at Georgia Public Broadcasting, and a lot of people who are here tonight have come because they are tremendous fans of you and your cooking. You also have some family members here tonight. But the real occasion is that you have just published your first cookbook, My Two Souths, Blending the Flavors of India into a Southern Kitchen. Your recipes are always remarkable, but your story is so great too. So let's talk about your journey from Kerala in the southern tip of India to the United States and your journey as a chef. Fair enough?
Sounds good.
You grew up. Tell us where Kerala is and what's the influence there?
It's the southernmost tip of India. It's kind of nestled between the Arabian Sea and the Indian Ocean. And if you know the map of India, it's just about 28 miles of the Indian Ocean that separates us from Sri Lanka. So it's literally at the tip of India. Very tropical, pristine. It's called God's own country. It really is one of the most beautiful places in the world. Huge port cities in the region that I come from. So in the years of the spice trade, you had Portuguese, Dutch, French, Chinese, people, Arab, come through those shores. And the cuisine in that particular region was really shaped by all these external influences that came into that region because of the fact that it happens to be a port city and was a huge central port city in the years of the spice trade. So the evolution of the cuisine of that space is really very different than what people tend to associate with Indian cuisine. So I think the American palates, and it's not the American palate's fault, but as immigrant chefs, when you come here, you bring these 9 classic recipes that you think everybody is going to just assume is Indian cuisine, and no matter
chicken,
where,
tandoori,
naan, palak paneer, yeah. Butter chicken, which is not even an Indian dish, it's actually British. so you know, it for me, this journey has been really fascinating beyond just being able to showcase a particular region, but to show the diversity that cuisine has and how diverse Indian cuisine really is. You know, I was raised Roman Catholic. I grew up eating beef, which when you think of Indian cuisine, you don't associate beef. You don't associate someone actually having been raised in a Christian faith. So
you point out that there was a huge Catholic influence. I mean, your name, Asha Gomez.
Yes.
People would not expect someone from India to have the name Gomez.
No, so the history behind the last names in that particular region happens to be back in the late 1500s, early 1600s, when the Portuguese traders came through those shores. Along with the traders also came missionaries. And in those days, India had something called the caste system. So your last name essentially dictated your caste, and your caste dictated if you were generationally rich or poor, if you had access to basic things like education. So what the missionaries brought with them were school systems. And masses that were the poorer of the lot that lived along the coastline. So if you know the map of India from going Goa, going down to that tip of India where I'm from, actually converted to Christianity. And when the conversions happened, not only did religion change, but the way we ate changed. We were no longer vegetarian. We started eating things like beef and pork. And when they baptized us, because the last name is what kept us to a certain caste, they threw us their last names. Hence, Diaz, Perez, Gomez, Fernandez, that entire stretch have, you know, has this very European influence when it comes to names. Yeah.
What was your life like? You grew up in the Caramel Compound?
Caramel Compound.
What does that mean?
So I come from a region that your family's wealth is distributed among siblings. And so land is distributed among siblings. And then you build a concave of houses and then you put a compound around it. And, you know, so our compound was called Carmel Compound, which is my grandma's name. And it's my mom and her three sisters who had houses in there. So they had these traditional kitchens. They had very modern kitchens in the home, but then in the back, there was one traditional kitchen that, you know, used coconut husk and firewood.
How many siblings?
For me, my immediate family, just four of us.
Four of you?
Yeah.
Okay. But you grew up with lots of cousins.
Lots of cousins. About 13 or 14 of them. I was the first girl after very many boys. So I was a total tomboy growing up.
So you came to the United States when you were 14, 15 years old? Finally, you'd been visiting here.
No, I actually came here for the first time when I was 13.
Okay, but when you finally moved here?
I was 16.
Okay.
Yeah.
And your ambition, and maybe this started when you were in India, you'll tell me, you never expected you were going to end up being a chef.
Oh, no.
You wanted to go... Maybe I'm not using a high-minded enough word for it. You wanted to go to beauty school.
I did. I wanted to be a beauty school dropout.
How did that go over with your family?
Not very well. So, yes, I did. I wanted to study this science called Ayurveda, which is a 5,000-year-old science of life in India. And so I did. I actually went back and I studied the science, and then I came back to New York and got my licensing in aesthetics. And so I was in the spa world for a good 15, 20 years before the food world came calling, which was just about 5 years ago.
Wow. And so, so you're... The first way that many people got to know you when you eventually moved to Atlanta was because you had a luxury spa. What was it called?
It was called Neemchi Spa. And because part of the science was that you had to touch all the senses. And so it was very important for me to actually touch the taste buds as well. So every treatment would end with a meal I had cooked. So it was like the hidden Indian restaurant. You had to get a facial or a massage to eat a plate of.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's interesting about you. You said, and this relates to that, you said you didn't find, and maybe I'm not quoting you precisely, but essentially you said, I didn't find cooking food. Food found me.
It did find me.
Because here you were in the spa business.
Yes.
But you can't resist cooking for people.
I could not resist. And, you know, Lana's here, and Lana was with me in the years as a spa. Literally, when we expanded, we built the kitchen first, because that was going to be such an important component of the spa. But in 2008, when the economy crashed, you know, we were an ultra luxury good, and we had to close. We were a casualty of the times. We had to close our doors. We literally went from 80%, 90% occupancy overnight to 20.
But and, an awful lot of your clients.
They wanted the food. Nobody was asking about the massage.
What were you cooking for them back in those days?
Back in those days, we were doing just vegetarian. We were just doing, you know, very wholesome vegetarian plates of food. It was vegetarian mostly.
You went on and opened Cardamom Hill. People loved Cardamom Hill.
What
was your concept?
So I think when I realized that this food had demand here, I realized the American palate had become very refined, and it did not want me as an immigrant chef to dumb my food down anymore. They wanted the authentic, they wanted the regionality that I brought to the table. And so really the concept became about showcasing the way I cook. And for me, what I put on a plate is essentially, it's a sum total of my life experiences, right? It's the two places that I've called home that happen to be southern regions across the globe, oceans and continents apart from each other. But I was able to find this commonality in these two regions. And so my food really became about showcasing these two places I was fortunate enough to call home.
Cardamom Hill was named by Bon Appetit as one of the 50 best new restaurants in the country in like 2013.
Yeah, and the Beard has.
And was a James Beard
nominee.
A nominee for best restaurant. People could not get in the door. And out of nowhere, really, on basically, am I right? One day's notice, you said, by the way, tonight's our last dinner.
Pretty much. You know, like I said, I'm not a classically trained chef. I really didn't understand the industry like I do today. You know, profit margins are razor thin in a restaurant industry. Hours are extremely rigorous. So if you want to have some semblance of a family life and, you know, have be in the carpool lane at 3 o'clock in the afternoon was close to impossible. And really wanted to make a life decision that enhanced the way that I actually lived my life. And working till 3 o'clock every morning was just not how I wanted to move forward. I would not have been able to write this book if I did that.
Well, we're going to talk about that in a minute. And you wanted more family time. I mean,
I did.
Your son, Ethan, is sitting right here. He is a, anybody who goes to Spice to Table.
He's our mascot.
He's... Okay, so let's talk about your food. Do you mind if I read something
Please.
To you from the cookbook?
Oh, I'd love to.
Right.
I'd love to hear it.
You really reject the term fusion.
It's the other F word.
Why is it so awful to talk about fusion?
I think that when I think fusion, I think chemistry. I think two things are colliding, an explosion is happening. It seems very unauthentic. It seems like I put two things together that didn't belong. For me, my food is an evolution of who I am as a person, you know, the places I've called home.
With that in mind, here's what you say in your introduction to My Two Souths. You say, this collection of recipes brings together the culinary roots of two special places where genuine hospitality and meaning are crucial ingredients. These two Souths are over 9,000 miles apart and would seem to be in separate universes. Surprisingly, I found their shared aspects, a warm, humid climate, abundant produce varieties, expanses of rice acreage, busy coastal communities, along with a spirit of sharing, a gift for entertaining and storytelling, a talent for creating bounty out of an often modest pantry, and a simple embrace of simplicity blend easily in my South by South cuisine. And you go on, but that's the essence of what
that's
this
the,
book is.
That is the book, yes. That one paragraph, I think the first two paragraphs of the book pretty much, if you pick it up, will give you the essence of the book, yes.
So anyone who is your friend on Facebook, and I know, how many do you have, by the way, at this point? A lot.
It's a couple of thousand. Yeah.
But anyone who is your friend on Facebook knows your love affair with cooking is just immense. There is not a day that goes by that you don't post a picture of some remarkable, beautiful food you're cooking for your family, for friends who are coming by, or for your private dinners at Third Space. It's exhausting. I really, at some points, I say, oh my gosh, she's cooking again for 200 people. Tell us about that passion.
I really love it. It doesn't feel like work. I enjoy being in the kitchen. I didn't necessarily enjoy being in a restaurant kitchen with 100 tickets in front of me because at some point I lost my joy for cooking because it just became about sending plates of food out. And so what I do now is really reclaiming that joy that I essentially felt when I cooked, which is just tremendous joy. For me, food is community. It is gathering around a table, and it is memories that last a lifetime. So,
and that shows every time I open your Facebook page. Okay, so I want to make sure I get this, and now we'll turn to some cooking. You mentioned three basic spices. I'm not sure I pronounce them. Kodampuli, what are they?
Kodampuli?
Yeah.
Okay.
What is that?
So kadambali is essentially, it's a very tangy fruit. And people tend to think it's in the tamarind family, but it's actually in the passion fruit family. We take that fruit, we sun dry it, and then we smoke it. When it gets in our kitchens, we then rehydrate that fruit, and it becomes the base of very many curries in the southern pantry in India. It has a very smoky, tangy flavor and does really, really well with chilies.
Okay.
It pairs well with chili.
The second one is a spice that comes from, you say, a giant 10-foot-tall plant. What is it? Asafoetida?
Oh, yeah. So asafoetida is a very potent spice. So if you actually don't, if you haven't worked with it, I recommend that, you know, someone show you. Like in the book, I give very specific instructions on how to use it. So asafoetida essentially is an overgrown fennel tree. It becomes into a tree. And the sap of that tree, just like if you would tap rubber, it comes out as this thick sap, and that sap is asafoetida. And back in the years of the spice trade, it was used as a meat tenderizer. Today, it's used as a flavoring ingredient.
Okay, and then the last one, and then I want to ask you about our ability to use these things. Okay. This is interesting. You say curry leaves.
Yes.
Now, one of the reasons I thought that was interesting when I read your book is I always thought, like when I think of curry powder,
yeah,
I always was told that curry powder is kind of this fake, made-up version of that it's not a genuine or authentic.
So in Indian cuisine, there's no such thing as curry powder.
Yeah.
When we say curry, we mean anything that is a sauce that has spices in it.
Right.
So it could be 10,000 variations of curry, you know, and all these different influences. And if you look across the world, it's thousands and thousands. So essentially, curry is a spicy sauce. But when I say spicy, I don't mean heat on your palate. It's a nuanced spice. It could be anything from cardamom to cumin to star anise. But curry leaf is essentially is just a plant that happens to be called curry leaf, and it has nothing to do with curry powder or curry.
So for people who are going to, you already said that asafoetida, you have very specific instructions for how to use it. We're going to find recipes in here that have these basic spices in some form or another.
Yeah, I think the book very much is also my love affair with spice.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up with it. I say it's part of my DNA, and I'm very familiar with it, so I'm not afraid of it. And so what I hope this book really does is that it brings spice into the American pantry. That you could take a familiar dish like a buttermilk biscuit or a cornbread or a hoe cake and start introducing these spices into it. It's not so intimidating because now you're working with dishes that you're familiar with. It doesn't feel like, oh, I'm cooking another cuisine. And really, it is about introducing spice into the American pantry.
I love that. We want to now dig into the book if we can. I've picked out some recipes that I think it'd be really fun to talk about, and I'll invite you to tell us others that you may want to discuss. But let's do this. Let's take a break. We're talking with Asha Gomez, one of the most acclaimed chefs in the Southeast. We're talking about her new and first cookbook, My Two Souths, Blending the Flavors of India into a Southern Kitchen. This is Two-Way Street. We'll be right back.
We gotta have a break.
Welcome back to Two-Way Street. Our guest today is Asha Gomez. She is one of the most acclaimed chefs in the Southeast, and many people, especially in the Metro Atlanta area, know her restaurant, Spice to Table. She's with us today because we're talking about her first cookbook, My Two Souths, Blending the Flavors of India into a Southern Kitchen. And we are recording this conversation, Asha, in front of a live audience here at the studios.
A very special live audience,
might
I
add. So I picked out a few things that I thought were interesting for different reasons. A couple of breakfast, a couple of maybe lunch and dinner things, and a dessert or two. All right. Appam, A-P-P-A-M.
Appam, yes. So, you know, when I had Cardamom Hill, people would walk in and always ask for naan or roti. And we never served that in our restaurant because the region that I come from doesn't actually, that's really not a bread that we eat in that region. Our predominant crop in Kerala is rice, and almost all our breads, our base of our breads, are made with rice. So essentially, we take long grain rice, we soak it overnight, the next day we grind it, we add coconut milk to it, we let it ferment, and then that dough becomes the base of multiple breads in the course of the week. So you could make it into an appam, which is an almost cakey center with crispy edges. You could make it into a pancake. You could add a little bit more sugar and some cashews and raisins and steam it up and make it into a sweet rice cake. So, you know, that's the predominant bread that I grew up eating.
One of the reasons I like it, first of all, it's a beautiful photograph of a beautiful egg on the page. I also picked it because... Where do we buy eggs and get really good quality eggs? Where do you go for eggs? Because the eggs I buy at my supermarket just aren't
right
really
there.
Good.
Manifold Farms, my favorite eggs in the city.
So you would advise yes. that most supermarket eggs are just not the way for us to have eggs.
Well, you know, I'm not an elitist when it comes to food because I honestly believe that the mom standing at Walmart buying food for her kid should never be made to feel less than the mother standing at Whole Foods
That's
buying food
really
for her kid.
That's a really lovely sentiment, but is that where you wouldn't buy your
eggs there? So if I have to, I will, of course, buy from a grocery store. But, you know, on those occasions when... Tim will send me gorgeous eggs that are these pale blue and beautiful hues of green, and the yolk is literally orange on the inside. Yeah, it's very exciting for me.
There's some beautiful descriptions of your home. Kerala's lush green landscape includes swaying coconut palms, curving, undulating rice paddies, and you say that these essentially are part of what goes into making this
yes.
dish. Golden Kachadi grits. Boy, talk about here. You're taking your Kerala roots
yes.
and blending them with the cuisine of the American South. Tell us a little bit about it. It's one of your favorite dishes.
It is. So when I had grits for the first time when I came to the American South, it was an instant love affair for me. I love the idea of porridges and, you know, warming foods, just stick to your bones kind of food. And I grew up eating something called khichdi, or it's a rice and lentil porridge, which has very much the same consistency that grits does. And so I said, you know, I was just sitting one day and I said, how do I kind of bring these two places together? So instead of creaming my grits with cheese, I cooked down yellow lentils and I folded into the grits like we would back in India, where we would take rice and fold in lentils. So it's, and then we put ginger and, you know.
Yeah, this is what I was going to say.
It's like
you
all kinds of yummy.
This is where we see that really
yes.
come forward.
So this is what's exciting to me. This is why I love these recipes coming into your kitchens, because, you know, I know you make a great pot of grits. So here I am. I want to introduce you to something different, a different way of making it, and bringing in that global world into your kitchens, and, you know, just having your children just learn all about the world through food in your own homes.
Will you allow me to pick one more of mine?
Yes.
Is there anyone in this room who doesn't want to hear a little more?
I know which it is.
What am I going to ask you about?
I think everybody here will say what it is. What recipe do you?
Kerala.
There you go.
Is that right?
Yes.
Your mother's recipe, is that correct?
It is. So
this is like what I mean, people go crazy for your Kerala chicken.
So I think the misconception that fried chicken is just a Southern American thing, I think I may have broken that myth, because I think every culture figured out if you drenched a bird in flour and deep fried it, it's probably going to be good. So I don't think there's, you could go any place in the world, there's a fried bird. Some of them don't use the flour on it, but there is a fried bird in every cuisine across the globe. And I grew up eating fried chicken. So, you know, it's a recipe for... It's really not, but it will be shocking to people the amount of garlic and ginger that goes into this recipe. So if you're going to make it and you're like, did she just say put all that? Yes, I did. I did tell you to put all that garlic and all that ginger.
Yeah, it's surprising how few ingredients.
It's
really are
very
involved.
Minimal, yes.
But what's also interesting, of course, to add to your cuisine of the American South, is your recipe calls for low country rice waffles.
Yes.
And spicy syrup, because goodness knows you wouldn't want to do a syrup that didn't have some of your spices.
There you go. So when I bought the fried chicken, and I serve it with, like my mom would serve it, with a rice pilaf. And I said, you know, here it's all about the chicken and waffles. So I found this amazing low country waffle recipe out of South Carolina that actually uses cooked rice in the batter. It's fantastic. So I stayed true to the integrity of that dish. I stayed true to the integrity of the fried chicken that came out of my mother's kitchen. And then what I brought to it, which I thought was just, you know, that perfect marriage that happened, was I took, instead of maple syrup, I took cane syrup. And I put coriander and cumin and crushed chili flakes. And
when did you first start cooking with your mother?
At a very young age, 13, younger even. I actually loved, my sister-in-law is here too, my mom's here. You know, my sister-in-law came into our home, God, 30-odd years ago. I was so young at the time. And I would just love going into the kitchen with her, and we would make coconut chutney. And, you know, she's a fantastic cook in her own right. So And my mom is an amazing cook as well. So
yes,
I was surrounded by great cooks.
Yes, but you've said in a couple of interviews, you first learned from your mother, and now you're proud that she's learning from you.
I hope
she's learning from you.
I hope she's learning. For me, what I, you know, there's always this constant battle of tradition against innovation, and I don't think one should be afraid of the other. I think it would be so sad if you couldn't innovate because you were afraid of tampering with tradition. We wouldn't have the cuisine we have in the world today if people didn't evolve and step out of those traditions every once in a while to create something magical and something new.
All right, you want to pick one recipe to tell us about? Is there one you really, really think we should know about?
I do. So it's called Chicken Country Captain. It is as Southern a dish as you can get.
Okay.
It dates back to the turn of the century. Savannah claims it. The reason it's called Chicken Country Captain is because the myth behind the recipe is that there was a British sailor who was a captain for the naval officers, British naval officers, who had been through India, obviously, on one of his tours and loved himself a curry chicken. Ends up calling the American South home and is trying to now replicate that curry chicken. But he doesn't have all the ingredients that he needs for the base of the dish that he's about to make. For me, if I'm starting a curry in our kitchen, it's onion, ginger, garlic. That's our trinity in Indian cooking, onion, ginger, garlic. Here in the South, you know, it's bell pepper, you know, onion and celery. So what he does is he takes that as the base, he replaces the onion, ginger, garlic, and does the base as celery, bell pepper, and onion, and creates this amazing curry chicken. And so for me, that dish is almost full circle, right? It originates from someplace, comes to the American South, and I almost feel like I'm drawing it now back to its roots.
I love this. You say, I replay in my mind a tale stretching from its fabled origins in India through its journey to the American South, with a certain seafaring country
captain.
So it ties together.
It does.
The place of your birth with your adopted home here in Atlanta, yes. Georgia. That's wonderful.
So that's my favorite recipe in the cookbook.
I get it. Let me talk about something else for a couple minutes. For you, cooking is all about really hospitality.
Yes.
Tell us the story of how you, who's Anna Quintrano?
Anna Quintrano is an amazing chef here. She's well-renowned across the country, and she, to me, embodies just perfection when it comes to cuisine. And
one
how
of the great
she,
chefs in the South, both one of the most famous and hard to get into restaurants.
Yes, Bacchanalia, Star Provisions.
All right, but tell the story about, so your spa was right next to Bacchanalia.
Yes, I was always so intimidated by Annie. Like if Annie was walking in one side of the street, I would cross over to the other side because I'm going to avoid that conversation and just scooty on over to the other
Annie
side.
Annie can be an intimidating woman. She's serious.
So when I started the restaurant, I remember I was in my kitchen cooking this one dish and you know, the accolades had started coming in, and I was in a state of shock. Every time someone wrote something, I would be like, oh my gosh, and I can't believe this is happening. I couldn't stop thinking of her because in my mind, I was thinking, you know, she is who I would aspire to be as a chef. And so that afternoon, I had this red clay pot, and I filled it up with that dish that I made. I'd never spoken to Annie before that. I wrote a note that said, I thought of you while I was making this dish, and thank you for being an inspiration. I hope you enjoy lunch. And I actually didn't have the time, so I sent somebody to drop it off at Star Provisions. It was 5:00, we start service at Cardamom Hill. At 4:30, the receptionist comes running into the kitchen. She's like, Annie Quintrano is here. And I literally, my knees buckled. I was like, what? And I remember I came running out of the kitchen. I said, Chef, it's such a pleasure to have you here. And she had the pot that I had sent. And she said, my mama told me never to return an empty pot, so I made your dinner for you. And
do you remember what she did?
She did. She made a creamy polenta with a curried shrimp for me. And it was the beginning of one of the most beautiful friendships I have.
That's a beautiful story. But, and you know, and it also speaks to your close, you really have a warmth for the chef community here in Atlanta.
Across the country. Okay, I think you put two chefs in a room together, you become family right away.
Food as a place for people to come together and get to know each other is really one of the most lovely things, I think, about what you've brought to us here in Atlanta.
That means a lot, and that's what food should always be. It's I understand that it's sustenance, and we obviously need it to live, but it is such an amazing medium in good times and in bad to sit around a table and commune over food, be it with friends, families, or a stranger that you commune over food with and you leave that table as friends. It happens every single time.
I want to come back to that, and there are some people in the audience who have been nodding as you say all those things. I want to come back to that, but there's another one of your recipes that we really, it kind of like Carol the Chicken, we have to talk about it. When people come to Spice to Table, one of the first things many people want is your chai. You also, in the book, talk about chai as such a great tradition growing up in India, and you tell us that teenagers in Kerala, when you were growing up, you'd go on the dates and you were cutting chai.
It's called cutting chai. I think my brother will attest to it. So you would get tea in a cup and a saucer, and you will share that tea with the person that you're with. Half the tea is poured into the saucer and half is on the cup, and it's called cutting chai. So you share that cup of tea.
Mm-hmm. Why is chai important to the Indian to people in India, and why is it does it remain so important here for you and the people who come to have meals
when,
with you?
You know, the Brits came and they stayed a couple hundred years longer than they should have, but they gave us tea, and they gave us English as a unifying language. So and they left us with a few good things. Tea happens to be one of them. And it's such a tradition for us. Like every household, you know, your day starts with tea. And then we have something like, we have a siesta at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, literally in every home. It stops. You're going to drink your cup of tea. And with your cup of tea, you'll have your snacky items like your fried goods or your little cakes and, you know, and kids are coming back from school at the time. Moms are home anyway. Business is actually closed for afternoon siesta and then will reopen later in the evening. So it really is a time for family to just commune. And the other tradition about tea that I love is, you know, literally anybody could walk into your house and join you for tea. It just is. If someone came to your home, the first thing, it's a sign of hospitality at its best. Yeah. You serve tea.
And you say that you always have chai boiling out. Is it boiled?
Yeah.
Boiling on
yep.
the stove.
Yeah.
Lots of cardamom pods in it, grated nutmeg, ginger powder.
Yes. So here's the thing about chai also. Every household, there's no one recipe for chai. Every household that you go north to south, east to west of India, they're going to have a different variation of tea. Some will put cloves, some will put cinnamon. For me, my chai has always been about cardamom and dry ginger powder. In the wintertime, I like to put a couple of whole black pepper kernels in there because when it's going down, it just really warms your throat and it really feels good.
Ooh, that sounds wonderful.
And you can strain it out, but you know, the thing about pepper is it hits you in your throat, but it's a very warming spice when you have it with that milk and that cream. So, yeah.
I'll tell you what we're going to do. Let's take our last break of the show. And when we come back, we will continue our conversation with Asha Gomez, author of a brand new cookbook, My Two Souths. And as we go to break, Asha, I should say that just this morning, the New York Times reviewed your book. It's a pretty glowing review. Among other things, and you've already sort of referred to this, Ms. Gomez's lack of a classical cooking education is in part what makes this cookbook delightful. She intuits the needs and desires of the home cook. A chicken and rice dish is fancy in both name and flavor, but it dirties just one pot. She has a firm grasp on the greatest recipe hits of the American South, but it's her command of the Indian spice box that emboldens her. So congratulations on
Thank
that.
You.
You also had a recipe in the Times the other day. I don't remember what it was.
Yeah, they put, I had a pumpkin, chicken, you know, chicken and dumpling is so big here in the American South. I actually grew up eating something back in the Indian South that was, we made dumplings with rice flour. And so this chicken and dumpling is dumplings that are made with rice flour, not, you know, all-purpose flour and pumpkin. So it's great for the fall.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation on Two-Way Street with Asha Gomez. Two-Way Street. We're here at GPB, our studios on 14th Street. We have a live studio audience with us. We're talking to Chef Asha Gomez, who is one of the most celebrated chefs here, certainly in Atlanta, but beyond that in the Southeast. And with the publication of her new book, My Two Souths, Blending the Flavors of India into a Southern Kitchen, it won't be long before she's going to be all over the country. We just have to hold on to her here. So Asha, I wanted to offer the audience a chance to ask you a few questions, and we have somebody right now who wants to ask something of you.
Good evening, Asha.
Hi, Fred.
How are you, love?
It's good to see you.
My question is pertains towards the future of food as well. As we sort of move forward, people have a greater sensibility about food, what they eat, things like that, quality of food as well. So, and cultures, the world shrinking, we're all sort of coming together. So food is coming together as well, and you are a shining example of that as well. So my question is, what do you sort of envision moving forward into the future, in the here and now, and then the beyond, as far as how we view food, what is food, how all of these different cultures come together, and how we make all of these wonderful new plated dishes that we have?
Thank you for that question. You know, I always use this as an example. I have an 11-year-old kid. I hope that 20 years from now, when he's in his kitchen cooking with his family, when he decides to make a cornbread with cardamom, when he decides to use talisheri black pepper with biscuit, it is not so out of the norm. It's what I and so many immigrant chefs bring to the landscape of cuisine in this country. And that's really what I see. Not just this book, but food, is that we as a global community have so much more interconnectedness than we realize. And food is such an amazing medium to showcase that. So if you are someone who cannot travel and see the world, like so many people are fortunate to, what better way is there to teach your children about other cuisines than through food? You're literally bringing another culture into your kitchen and exposing your children to another culture, another heritage, another tradition that they can actually own and make their own. Gone are the days when if I had to make a particular dish, there's just no way I could. I had to visit that country. I had to know someone from that country. Today, everything in this global market is at my fingertip, right? But yet, when I go to the supermarket, I will see my fellow Americans standing next to the red bliss potato or the russet potato or the gold potato or the white potato. Yet across the aisle, there's 25 different root vegetables that you're afraid to touch because you're not familiar with it. And it is a starch just like potato is. So I encourage you to walk across that aisle, step out of your comfort zone, pick up that fruit or vegetable that you're not familiar with, and cook with it. We have Google. It'll take you 3 seconds to come up with a recipe.
So here's the questions that a couple people asked if I would ask you. One was, when you were young, what were the snacks you were eating in Kerala when you came home from school?
So it was a lot of fruit. I'm a fruit bat. I must have been a fruit bat in another life. Because, you know, we have 600 varieties of mangoes in India. You come home mango season after school, the first thing you want to do is run into that room that has the mangoes ripening, and you just want to dig your nose into it, smell the aromas. And, you know, my love affair with food started with a singular mango at the age of 6. and, you know, it continues to this day into my 40s. But we had things like cookies, but we make it a little differently because we didn't really have ovens. And so the way they baked there is very different from here. It would be brick, and heat and steam, or a lot of fried things that we would eat when we came home in the evenings. Like here you have beignets. I grew up eating something called kos, which essentially is a banana beignet, the overripe bananas that are just mixed into dough and then powdered sugar on top of it. So all your guilty pleasure happened in the evenings.
And what do you give Ethan for snacks, or maybe what do you pack when you send lunch to him?
So here's the thing. Considering the times that we are in, I guess it's, for me, it's important that I say this. My kid is as American as they come.
How old is he? I'm sorry.
He's 11.
Okay, go ahead.
Right? He associates himself with no other country than the U.S. This is his home. This is his land. This is what he's, this is the only place he's known as home. His sensibility is very much that of any other American kid. I try to keep tradition going in my kitchen so he can have these roots. But at the end of the day, this is home. This is his home. And it is so important for people to understand that. He was asked recently in school about his Indian heritage, like he was an outsider. And, you know, that is not the way the question has to be phrased. The question is, tell us about your roots, about your pride in your roots, not where do you come from? Well, he comes from here. This is his home. So his sensibility is as American as they come. He wants to have pizza, and he wants to eat a bowl of pasta. but then he loves a tremendous fish curry. So, you know, he's fortunate enough to be exposed to all these different cultures.
Yeah, just to be clear, I really wasn't asking that question because I had this sense that Ethan wouldn't be eating what every kid does.
No.
It's more about what you as a mom wanted to eat.
Exactly. And for me, it's also convenience, right? When you're a mom, it's all, not always about making elaborate meals at home. I am big on making one dish pots. It's easy. It's simple. It's got your protein. It's got your starch. It's got some vegetables in it. And I love those one pot dishes like that chicken and rice dish that they talked about.
Okay. A couple other questions because we're getting close to being out of time. One, Thanksgiving is a month or so away. What does Thanksgiving look like at your house? Is it American as American can be, or do you?
Yes, it is. I'm a traditionalist. I do not want anything on my turkey but butter and salt and pepper.
Okay.
And I want gravy and I want mashed potatoes. I want all the trimmings. That is one holiday that I want traditional Thanksgiving.
All right.
Yeah.
As we come to a close,
mm-hmm.
you really gave us our closing. You talked about your sense that we can find a way to come together as cultures through our cuisine. Now, this is not a political show, and so I'm not asking you to talk about an election or that sort of. But as you look around at the divisiveness that we're going through right now, are you looking for ways when you have a book like this bringing, you know, various foods together from different cultures? Do you see hope for us?
Absolutely.
In the way we eat together and celebrate food from our cultures together?
I see nothing but hope for us. I see nothing but cultures intermingling. And like I said, you know, if you're in your kitchen and you're making this, then you've already welcomed me into your home. And thank you for that, because it means so much.
Right. I have to interrupt you because we are completely out of time. Mm-hmm. Our guest today on Two-Way Street, Asha Gomez. My Two Souths, Blending the Flavors of India into a Southern Kitchen, is available now. Also, of course, her restaurant, Spice to Table, is down in the old Fourth Ward in Studio Plex, and I'm sure you're there at lunchtime virtually every day. You're not, but they can eat your food there.
Yes, they can.
Asha, thank you so much for being with us today. And thank you to the audience who's been here to see you talk about your new
book
and your food. About out of time for today's show. Remember, there are many ways you can listen to us.
We love it when you tune into the show when we're actually on the radio, but you can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or get it from your favorite podcast provider. And all of our shows are archived on the Two Way Street website. If you go there, some of the shows you can catch up with include our conversations with best-selling crime novelist Carl Hiaasen, the great blues artist Tinsley Ellis, or the Broadway director Kenny Leon talking about his theater roots right here in Georgia. Our producer is the perpetually positive Trevor Young. Our senior producer is the practically perfect Jenny Amond. Jenny also edited this week's show. And we have a special shout-out to GPB's Kimberly Grooms, who handled all the arrangements for the live audience that came to see our recording of today's show. I'm Bill Nigut. Thanks for listening, and I hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.